When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
What up? It's The Crossover. I'm Howard Beck, senior writer for Sports Illustrated. Welcome back to the Friday edition of The Crossover. Yes, we have doubled the number of episodes at no extra cost to you, the consumer. We're generous that way. Tuesdays, it's Chris Mannix and me breaking down all the latest from around the NBA. And then on Fridays, it is me and a guest. Could be a player, coach, pundit, musician, actor. We kicked it off a couple weeks back with Hip Hop Legends Tag Team. Last week, it was comedians Sam Morrell and Stav Halkias talking about their beloved Knicks. And today, I have the NBA's scheduling czar. His name is Evan Wash. His actual title, Executive Vice President of Basketball Strategy and Analytics. I like calling him the czar. He is among those who's tasked with creating the NBA schedule and navigating all the challenges that come with it. Of course, those challenges are quadrupled in a year like this one. But the play-in tournament that we are all buzzing about, that is also Evan's department. The challenges and craziness of this season, that's his job to manage. Are injuries up? Is tanking down? How is the NBA navigating just all of this? We will get into all of that with Evan. Before we get to that, a reminder, please subscribe, rate, and review The Crossover wherever you get your podcasts. You can hit me with any feedback on Twitter. I'm at Howard Beck. And okay, everything you ever wanted to know about the play-ins, playoffs, compressed schedules, all of it with Evan Wash coming up next. So stick around.
This is The Crossover, an NBA show hosted by Sports Illustrated's Chris Mannix and Howard Beck.
It's a whole new level for you and me, Chris, this relationship.
Like and subscribe for the best weekly NBA content these two are capable of.
What does that mean?
Could be the best duo ever.
I don't see how you can beat that.
Here they are, Chris Mannix and Howard Beck.
Now, pleased to be joined by the NBA's Executive Vice President of Basketball Strategy and Analytics. I like to just call him the scheduling czar. It's a more fun title. Evan Wash. Evan, how are you?
I'm doing well, Howard. How are you?
I'm doing well, too. Can you get scheduling czar on your business card? It would take up less ink. It would save money. It would save space. Cooler.
We actually have one of those. Tom Corelli, who heads up our scheduling group, is my partner in crime there. So I think we'd have to share that.
Does his say scheduling czar?
It might. You'll have to check with him next time.
Tell Adam Silver I want more czar titles in the NBA. I cannot figure out for the life of me, like executive VP, senior VP, like all that. I don't even know the pecking order of that. Who's higher? It's very confusing to me. Wow. But I know what a czar is. Czar's in charge.
Noted.
On my previous podcast in a previous lifetime, you and Tom were on together with me. We talked about the schedule a couple of times, and it's always fascinating. And so I thought this would be actually a great time to bring you on now in the context of this season, because we are recording this with about 2 weeks or so to go in this weird regular season. And it's been the most challenging one, I would assume, probably ever for those of you building the schedule and many twists and turns and curves and stuff along the way. But I actually want to start here because I had a story earlier this week, which you and I spoke for last weekend, about the play-in and the effect it's having on competition late in the season. And at the time that you and I spoke, you said it was actually a record. 24 teams were still in play for something with 15 games left. As of right now, as you and I are recording, there are between 8 and 11 games, I believe, for all teams. And a couple teams I would say are out now. I would say that that in the West, New Orleans and Sacramento are now out. So there's really only 10 teams still going in the West. But Chicago and Toronto still have a chance at the play-in in the East. So I think we're now down to like 22 teams. Is this still, by all historical standards, the most competitive late season we've seen?
It is. So I thought you might ask that. So we refreshed the numbers this morning. So yes, the largest comeback with 10 games left in the season, which is where we are on average for teams at this point, is 3 games behind a playoff spot with 10 to go. And so by that measure, we have 22 teams, as you said, either in a sort of opportunity to qualify for the playoffs directly or through the play-in, or within 3-game threshold of that 10th seed. And that remains the highest number we've ever had. The previous high was 21 teams, which of course is a function of increasing the field of teams that have an opportunity to qualify for the playoffs by virtue of the play-in, but that's the spirit of it. And so yes, we you know, you'll have a dwindling field as we get closer, but there will be a minimum of 20 teams in it until the end of the regular season, and in fact, until the play-in starts. And so we're hopeful that that can really boost the quality of the end-of-season competition.
Yeah, and I think it's looking that way so far. And I'm always skeptical on these things, Evan. Every time there's like proposals to change the schedule or throw in midseason tournaments and other things, I'm always a little, maybe I'm too much of a traditionalist, but this one feels like it's really worked very well. And I think the only complaint people could have would be, well, you know, why do I care that this team that, especially in the East, might end up 6 games under 500 is now making it into the playoffs or squeaking in via the play-in. Although I would say, even to that, in the West, like the Warriors are at 500. So like if the Warriors make the play-in, first of all, fundamentally a good thing for Steph Curry to be involved in the postseason, however long that lasts, but also like the Warriors as a 500 team in 10th place right now, like that's not crazy. Like you've had losing records in the actual playoffs before in this league. So how do people at the league level feeling about, is there any squeamishness about the idea that, okay, but some teams are now could get in having finished the regular season 5 or 6 games under 500?
Yeah, it's certainly no concern from my perspective. I mean, if you take a step back, prior to the institution of the play-in, we were a league where 16 of 30 teams qualify for the playoffs. More than half our league qualifies for the playoffs. And if you had a normal distribution of records, meaning, you know, the sort of 2 teams right in the middle are either at 500, 1 game above, 1 game below, et cetera, you're going to have on average 1 team every year that has an under 500 record making the playoffs, because you're putting a team in the playoffs, the 16th playoff team, that is by definition a below average team, because there's 30 teams and they're 16th out of 30. So when you come from that starting point, you can't be squeamish about teams with under 500 records making the playoffs, because that's a mathematical expectation of our system. I think what gets lost in the play-in conversation a lot is this is not just about what you do with those bottom teams. This is about a fundamental overhaul of the competitive dynamics throughout the standings. And the reason for that is we want to create tiers that teams are always competing for, and that there's always an achievement by moving up in the standings. And so in a typical year prior to the play-in, a team that's locked in a playoff spot may not see a particular benefit from moving up from the 7 to the 6 or the 6 to the 5, especially if there's some issue with the matchup that's going to result from that seed. And so you might say, well, yeah, I'm not going to have home court advantage. It's unlikely, you know, as a 6 or 7 seed that I'm going to host a conference finals where I have home court advantage against an 8 seed. So really this is more about matchup for me. And we wanted to make sure that teams throughout the standings have that incentive to compete right to the end. And so what we've done with the play-in is actually create 4 different tiers in the standings instead of 2. So we're coming from a world where we have playoff teams and non-playoff teams. And now we've got top 6, the teams that lock themselves into a playoff spot. You've got 7 and 8, which is a tier unto itself now, because those teams have 2 chances to win 1 game in the play-in, basically double elimination to qualify. You've got 9, 10, which are teams now that previously didn't have a chance and now do, but they have to win 2 in a row to get in. And then you've got the bottom 5. And so going from 2 to 4 tiers, and obviously you could break it down even further. You could say within the top 6, of course, you want to get to 4 because that means home court advantage in the first round. You want to get to 1 or 2 because that means home court advantage in the second round, et cetera. And so there's now an argument that throughout the standings, every team can look 1 or 2 or 3 spots ahead of them and say, you know what, there's significant value to me achieving that level. And so that's the spirit of the play-in. And it doesn't particularly matter to me if a team that is 10th and had an underperforming record gets hot, wins 2 games in a play-in and you know, takes up what would have been a playoff spot from the 7th or 8th seed. Like, that's the spirit of competition that we're looking to drive.
Yeah. And it's funny. So then those tiers are important, right? Because yeah, before it was, well, if you can't make it to the home court bracket, the 1 through 4, then okay, where does it matter where you fall, unless maybe it's just a matchup issue, but there are more incentives, obviously, at the 4th spot for home court, as you mentioned, for 6th spot to ensure you're in the playoffs. 7th and 8th have the advantage in that 7 through 10 bracket because of the double elimination, as you've explained. And I should explain for the listeners, for people who are still trying to get their head around the play-in. So when the regular season is over, 7 will play 8. That's a game. 9 will play 10. The winner of 7-8 becomes the 7th seed. That team is now locked in. The loser of that game between 7 and 8 plays the winner of 9-10. And the winner of that game now becomes the 8th seed. And so there's a lot of potential jockeying right now. And it's funny, I will say it so that you don't have to, but when Mark Cuban was complaining about, well, what if we don't get it to the 6th seed or now we have to go all out to get to the 6th seed, and you know, late in the season you want to be able to like rest guys or whatever, not risk injury. Like, that's the whole point. Like, the Mavericks had to work, and they have, and hey, to their credit, I think last I checked, I think they are in 6th, right? So they're doing fine. The Mavericks are going to be okay. But in the meantime, we've had much more interesting things to watch in the day-to-day jockeying for position. I cannot see a downside. Are you guys still getting any pushback on this, or is the league as a whole at the league level and team level feeling pretty good about the way this is unfolding right now?
Yeah. So I think a few things. We're certainly, you know, you mentioned one team that has been vocal in their criticism, and we're certainly getting some of that, as we did when we initially discussed having a play-in tournament, which is if a team over the course of 82 games earns that what they felt is earning the 7th seed, for example. And when you don't put, you know, thresholds on these things in terms of the number of games between 7, 8, or 8 and 9, you could have a 7th seed that is significantly better in terms of win-loss record than a 10 seed. And there was a feeling, and some still feel, that after having put in that body of work for 82 games, the possibility of losing your playoff spot after, you know, with 2 losses in a row is a bit tough, right? And we hear that, and it's sort of, that's just the trade-off of what you and I are talking about in terms of the benefits. The other one that's been highlighted this year is interesting, because one of the reasons we felt that the play-in was so important this particular year was we knew there were going to be some inequities resulting, you know, from all the issues we had to deal with around COVID this year, whether that was periods of time where a team couldn't play, right? Like, so the Memphises and San Antonios of the world who were unable to play for an extended stretch and now have to play a much more dense second half schedule, or teams that had COVID issues but played through them because, you know, the rest of the team was unaffected, but they were shorthanded for a period of time. We have a number of teams in that bucket. And so we knew that that was going to happen in terms of back-to-backs and travel and density. Was it was maybe going to be an imbalanced year. And so expanding playoff opportunity to more teams just made sense in that year to try to smooth out some of those imbalances and really capture at the end of the year the teams that are best positioned for the playoffs. But the flip side of that is in a tough year like this, where the players and coaches and teams have made so many sacrifices to live under these restrictive protocols and go through daily testing and you know, play a slightly more dense schedule, it is challenging to then say, we're actually, you know, now going to not reward the 7th seed for something that they may have earned through that really challenging year. So I think, again, double-edged sword on that, but the longer term view is certainly that this will not just increase regular season competition, but the other piece we haven't talked about yet is we're about to get some incredibly exciting single elimination or qualification games. And so, you know, from Tuesday to Friday, immediately after the regular season, we're going to get 6 games where either a playoff spot is at stake or knockout is at stake. And In a typical year, we actually only average about 3 or 4 game sevens throughout the entire playoffs, right? And some years we've had as few as 1. I think we've never had more than 5, at least in the last, you know, 10 or 15 years. So we're getting 6 of those games guaranteed. And to your point, there's actually some pretty exciting teams and storylines in the mix, even though these are, you know, sort of middling teams by record So I think that's just another element that we can't overlook in terms of the fan side of this as well.
And, you know, it's interesting because, like, oh, so this year, as you point out, you know, you kind of want to build in more room for error or make it a little more forgiving, get more teams involved because of how unusual this year is. And even in a normal year, I would say, Evan, like, there are teams where injuries really knock a team off kilter early on, and maybe they never recover. And so a team that actually had good talent misses the playoffs. And that's just like, that's the breaks. That's sports, that it happens. But I would just say this year in particular, and with regard to COVID. So here are the Wizards. They're in 10th as you and I speak right now. They're 28-34. They're 6 games under 500, but they've got two of the most exciting players in the league, Bradley Beal, who's in the running for the scoring title, and Russell Westbrook, who's just a one-man show anywhere he is ever. And we all thought they would be competing for a playoff spot. They're 10th right now, but they're pretty, they're looking very likely to make the play-in. It can only be a good thing, I would say, for any NBA fan, no matter who you root for, to see a team with Russell Westbrook and Bradley Beal playing at least one game and maybe multiple and maybe making the playoffs after overcoming, and I point to the Wizards in particular, overcoming one of the toughest COVID obstacles that any team had. They were wiped out for two straight weeks. They didn't play a game for two straight weeks, couldn't practice, didn't have enough players. Like this is exactly the point of it. Like they are better than their record suggests, and now they're showing it, and it can only be a good thing for fans, for the league, for ratings, whoever, for them to at least have a chance to get in and have a couple of these, you know, playing games to get there. So, and then as I noted earlier, you know, the Warriors, I mean, I always thought they were a fringe playoff team, but again, there's no downside to having Steph Curry playing a game or two to try to make it in. And then if they make it in as the eighth seed, again, like I like who could complain about that other than the teams that got beat by Steph Curry or by Bradley Beal?
Yeah, absolutely. And I, you know, to take it a step further, those both of those teams not only are currently within the play-in realm, right? Both currently sitting in 10th, but both have a very realistic shot of getting to 8, right? Washington is 2 games back of the 8 seed, and Golden State is a half game back of the 8 seed at the moment. And so they see an opportunity now. Oh, if we can get to 8, guess what? We now give ourselves 2 chances to get in, as opposed to having, you know, as a 10 seed, even worse, having to go on the road for 2 straight games, right? You didn't sort of specifically mention this in your overview of the tournament, but that 7-8 game will be hosted by the 7 seed. The 9-10 game will be hosted by the 9th seed. And then the final game will be hosted by the loser of the 7-8 game. And so as a 10 seed, you're going on the road to play the 9. And if you win that, you're going on the road to play the loser of the 7-8. So that's an even tougher test. So there's value in being 9 to give yourself at least the home game first, right? To get through that first knockout game. And so every team in that zone is now looking at it and saying, yeah, I'm not just even satisfied sitting at 10 because I fought my way back into the playing field. I want to give myself a better chance of making it through. And then, you know, with the unique nature of the year, like this might be the year where a tip, you know, a 7 or 8 seed coming into the playoffs has a you know, more realistic shot of an upset than they would in a normal year because of how different everything is.
Do we know yet, Evan, like from a, just from a chatter perspective, right? The water cooler perspective, like all those of us who obsess over the standings and who's in the race and all this, like it's fun right now because of all this that we're talking about. Does the league have a sense of whether or not this increased competition, the increased stakes down the stretch has actually had a calculable effect? Like, can you see it in the ratings yet or fan engagement in other ways? Like it's to the extent that this is also supposed to keep people interested. Is it working? Do we know?
Yeah. One high level metric is our national TV ratings were up 25% in April relative to March. And so, you know, I think a lot of people just forgot about the play-in for the first half of the year, right? Everyone was so focused on like, yeah, we're back, we're in market, fans are starting to come back, you know, live competition, all these things, like COVID protocols, the issues the teams had, and people weren't really focused on playoff races. I think coming out of All-Star, there started to be a lot more focus within our teams, fans, media talking about the play-in and the races we were about to see. And so that manifested itself in the month of April in terms of viewership. And I think, you know, with, as you said, with just over 2 weeks left, I think you'll see even more of that in May when, you know, with 10 games left, every game essentially featuring any team in that 4-12 range, you know, in both conferences essentially could be determining someone's fate in terms of where they end up.
All right. So with apologies, I'm going to put my cynical journalist hat back on. The cranky Howard Beck, we're going into the playoffs and it's time for me to start sniping about grievances that I've had for 20 years about the NBA playoffs. All this is fun, but all of this is just jockeying to be the seventh and eighth seeds, which I have written recently are cannon fodder. Because there's no, ever since the best of seven was instituted for the first round, which I hate, I loved the best of five, which ended, I think 2002, three, somewhere in there. It just doesn't feel like there's that much suspense, and this is not an issue we're going to resolve on this podcast. I'm curious just as a general matter, because all this play-in stuff, it's just to determine the two teams that almost certainly will lose in, you know, five, six games in the first round anyway. I like suspense. I want to know that there is at least some possibility of an upset. It's why people love March Madness. I don't know why people love the uncertainty and the suspense of March Madness and the possibility that a high seed can get knocked out. And ooh, upsets are fun. But in the NBA, people like, no. We wouldn't want to have a first or second seed knocked out. We want to make sure that those teams go. It's a weird thing. Has there been any discussions substantively in the last couple of years about, like, is there a new way, any other thoughts about having to, or about a formatting the first round so there's less predictability?
Yeah. So a few things there as well. I generally agree in a 1-8 matchup, right? History shows that barring, you know, injury, we've had some examples of those, or five game series, you know, as you mentioned, it's very difficult for an eight seed to win a seven game series, but it has happened. You know, the 2-7 is a little more of a balanced matchup. Obviously two is heavily favored, but there are more examples of seven seeds winning. And I would equate that to the NCAA tournament. Like, until 3 years ago, a 16 seed had never beaten a one seed, and then it happened. It's not going to happen frequently, but it will happen. But obviously, as you get sort of down those matchups, everyone knows the sort of 5-12 lore and that type of stuff. So I think there's nothing wrong with a top seed being significantly favored. And in fact, there's two things going on there. One is the top seed is a top seed because they earned that seed by playing really well over the course of the season, which is probably indicative of them being a strong team who's going to perform well in the playoffs. And they've got home court advantage against, as I said before, a weaker team, a roughly league average team. And so you wouldn't expect your league average teams to beat your top teams too often over the course of a seven game series. And we think that's the right outcome for a league that has a playoff structured like we do. That said, there are other ways that you could structure playoffs if you wanted to introduce more randomness and opportunity, or more uncertainty and opportunity for lower seeds. So for example, when we were kicking around, you know, formats for the bubble last summer and trying to deal with the fact that we had more than 16 teams still in contention at the point that we paused the season, but didn't want to elongate the amount of time that we were in the bubble because of all the stress and strain that was going to place on teams and players. We looked at something like group play, you know, which got reported last year, where you'd not be placed in a series, but you'd be placed in a group. And it could be, let's say, if you were, you know, last year, if it was 20 teams, it would have been four groups of five. If you're in a 16 team field, it's four groups of four, and essentially playing everyone in your group home and away each. And so you end up with, you know, six or eight group stage games, and then the top two teams advance. And it's obviously a model that's familiar from a lot of international competitions, Olympics, World Cup, et cetera, Champions League. And that does give greater opportunity to lower seeds and more, you know, more opportunity or greater chances to advance. But of course, in doing so, it reduces the sort of reward for being a top team and reduces the opportunity for our best teams to showcase their talents late in the playoffs. So you're right. It's a bit of a, you know, it's a sort of first round, later round trade-off that maybe we could generate more interest in the first round with some format changes, but would we be, as you know, taking a hit later on when we know the teams that are going to drive the most interest in our later playoff rounds in the finals are typically our top teams with our top stars.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I like the idea, even if there's not going to be an upset ultimately, Evan, you know, I was there for, you know, Lakers Kings, say in 2000, best of five first round. And the Lakers just destroyed the Kings in the fifth game of that. But for a minute there, they were tied 2-2, and the Lakers, who had won 67 games with Shaq and Kobe and Phil Jackson, all of a sudden are on the brink of what seemed like elimination. And even though they win handily, it was, you know, the suspense of that moment, I thought was a value. Like, there, these stakes are so much higher in best of five. I know we're never getting a best of five back. I should just give it up, but I'm obligated to myself to at least once a year bring this up and complain.
Yeah, but I'm just repeating what I said earlier. I do think this is a very interesting and unique year where a team that makes it through the play-in might think they got a better shot, because really anything can happen. Leading into that series, not all of our top teams are fully healthy right now. So there may be more opportunity than a normal year.
Let's talk about injuries for a minute, because every year we go through this, and this year it seems like more than usual, where as soon as we see a spat of injuries, and especially if it's high profile guys, we immediately start hand-wringing and going, oh my God, injuries must be up. And this year, because of the compressed schedule, it certainly feels that way. And so anecdotally, I think fans just probably feel like that's the case right now. I actually have a question about the compressed schedule too, but just from the numbers that you guys have been tracking, are injuries up, down, around average? Where are we as of right now with a couple weeks to go?
They are down relative to last year, which will be surprising to people. And I think they're right in line with sort of a, 5-year longer term average, a period we've really, really monitored injuries most closely. So, measuring by something like the number of injuries that caused missed game time. Again, that's a number that's down relative to last year. Recognize the perception that it's up, and it could be a function of the timing, that there was sort of a concentrated period of injuries, particularly to top players, that caused them to miss time. Many of those players are now back or about to come back. On a full season basis, we are actually down relative to last year and in line with our averages.
So the craziness of this schedule, and especially of the second half of the season, where you guys had to jam in a bunch of extra games from the postponements back in January, as far as we can tell, there's no reason to believe that the schedule, the nature of this schedule, has caused more guys to be hurt or seriously hurt.
No, we don't. We certainly don't believe that. If you look at the whole season schedule, teams were set to play about 3.6 games per week this year, which compares to about 3.42 in our last few years. So you're talking about, less than 0.2 additional games a week, or less than one additional game a month. Mm-hmm. So not a lot in aggregate. And if you look further back, prior to the 2017 CBA, the regular season footprint was actually a week shorter, right? We extended the regular season footprint starting with the 17-18 season. And so prior to that, we were right at that 3.6 games per week number. So this year's schedule, as surprising as it may sound, was right in line with the schedules we used to play prior to 3 years ago, and only a tiny bit higher than the more recent ones. As you know, we're a little bit more dense in the second half because of the postponements, but sort of still nothing that's too out of line with history. I think what gets lost in that is that doesn't mean that this was not a difficult year, that the number of games per week or per month is not the only measure here, because the unique factor here was the unbelievably challenging protocols and schedules outside of gameplay that teams and players have been subjected to. So everything from the testing to the limitations on social activities, all the things that we had to do to stay safe through the year, those create incredible mental stress. And we are obviously incredibly grateful to our players and teams for having, made the sacrifices they did to go through this. So I think the game count is just one factor that's leading to this sense that this has been a particularly arduous year. And I think it would be fair to say those other things certainly drove it as well.
Is the number of games per week for you mentioned the per week per month for the season as a whole, but since the second half is more compressed, is that number significant? Is that number higher?
The problem is it's very variant, because again, like the teams that had few postponements in the first half
Didn't have as many.
So for example, in the second half schedule, we had teams playing as few as 34 games and teams playing as many as 40. So for the teams playing 40 games, it's incredibly dense and looks a lot more like the 2011-12 lockout year, which was, where we had three in a row, for example. We don't have any of those this year. But for those teams, it's really challenging. And in fact, we've not had four games and five nights on the schedule for the last several years. We eliminated them about 4 years ago. We had to incorporate those for a few teams. So four teams out of 30 ended up having to play four and fives this year as a function of postponements. But that means 26 teams did not have to play four and five. So for most of the league, the second half is still in line with the past, but obviously for the teams at that high end, yeah, it's significantly more dense.
I can't remember where I saw this, read this, heard this. Somebody suggested that this season is still actually more spread out than the lockout year, the last lockout 11-12. Is that
true? The league average density in the second half is about 3.75 games per week. So up from that 3.6 full season number, the lockout year was well up over 3.8. It was like 3.85 or something. So it was, we played, 66 games effectively from Christmas to mid to late April. So 66 games in 4 months is, much more than almost all of our teams have had to do this year.
Yeah. So even though in the midst of this, it feels like this is the craziest thing we've ever seen, the most compressed we've ever seen, everything else, it's not even statistically true.
Correct. And I think a lot of that has to do with those outside factors, right? The fact that it's, the teams are, living under much more restrictive protocols and testing and the early wakeups. Like I think that just adds to it. I will add that, we also worked really hard because we knew those things were going to be true and difficult this year. We worked really hard to cut down on travel because we knew that was going to be an added burden and potentially a risk. And so on a apples to apples basis, we have about 15% less travel this year. And then when you factor in that there's actually fewer games, right, we're only playing 72 games, it's actually 25% less travel than a normal year. And that's, you see that when you see these so-called series we've played where two teams play consecutive games in the same market. We've significantly reduced the number of one game road trips, right? Because if you think about it, every time you play a one game road trip, that's like an extra flight. Because if you just paired that game with another road game, well, guess what? You don't have to fly home in between the road games. And so I think we have about 50% fewer single game road trips this year. So teams are getting the travel benefit of some of those elements that we tried to build in, understanding how difficult all the rest of it would be.
Let me hit that issue for a minute here, because I think one of the interesting things has been seeing these two game sets, which, even in a normal season, occasionally a team will have like a home and home, two teams will play each other consecutively, one in each arena. But this idea of a two game set in one city is unique to this season. To the extent that less travel has benefits for, player health and rest and all these other things, is there any talk about keeping this in a normal season when we presumably, knock on wood, fingers crossed, everything else return to normal next season? Is there a chance of keeping an element like that or other elements? Have you guys found some things within this season that were forced on you or that you needed to do just to get this done that you can continue into a full normal 82 game season?
Yeah, absolutely. We will discuss it. The historical reason that we shied away from a series model was more about the business side, meaning if you are the home team hosting two consecutive games with the same opponent, and let's say that's a lower tier opponent, that there might be ticket sales challenges and attendance challenges from having that same team in your market for two consecutive games. And so that wasn't as much of an issue this year, of course, with limited capacity buildings and in many cases, no fans. And so we were able to sort of clear that hurdle. And so we'll have to think about what that business impact might be in a normal year when hopefully we're returning to full capacity. And then from a competitive side, there's really two elements. One is, yes, it's certainly a benefit for the road team to reduce travel and not have to take a second flight to that market later in the year. Of course, by definition, that means it's a disadvantage to the home team, right? Because now for that second game, the home team is no longer getting the benefit of playing a team that just had to travel in. And so depending on a team's view as to whether they would like to focus on their own travel reduction or the benefit that their road opponents are going to get when they come into the market, you might have a different view. And also we've heard from some teams, this is sort of luck of the draw, but if you happen to get an opponent for two straight games when their star player is out, right, that's a benefit. Whereas if you happen to play them later in the year for two straight games when their star is back, that's a disadvantage. And so teams have said that you can mute that a little bit when you spread out matchups among opponents, right? And we hear this every year that independent of consecutive games, a team would say, well, I've got all four of my matchups with team X fall in the month of December, right? And that's tough because they were playing really well to start the year. Like, okay, but it very well could have been the opposite. They could have been playing poorly to start the year and turned it on late. And so we generally think all of that comes out in the wash. But the only reason to do this would be if teams from a basketball perspective think it's healthy for rest and recovery, for injury prevention, for travel reduction, et cetera. And so we plan to have a pretty, you know, holistic discussion with the teams once the season concludes as to what was that basketball benefit. Can we quantify it? And is it worth whatever the business downsides might be in a world with full fans?
I'll be curious how that, I would love to be a fly on the wall for that. Cause I also know that, you know, there are certain teams in certain cities where they might have a little bit of advantage of having teams stay in their cities a little bit longer, that those teams might, wear themselves out with certain activities over the course of days in places like, oh, I don't know, LA, Miami, New York, Atlanta.
Well, yeah, certainly understand the market specifics there. And we've been doing some of that for years with the two-team markets, right? So LA, New York, Chicago, Milwaukee, places where you can go from one team to the other without flying. And we've tried to do that. So if an East Coast team is heading out to LA, it is obviously much more efficient for them to play the Lakers and Clippers in consecutive games, and vice versa in New York. And so that's been a focus of the schedule for a few years, because that doesn't trigger those business issues to the same extent, because it's a different home team. So you know, we'd have to obviously talk about that as well from a market perspective. The only other one, you know, you asked about kind of learnings from this year is the two half schedule release. We've talked about that a lot as to whether that's something that could benefit us. And you know, the primary reason that we did it this year was to give ourselves a better chance of rescheduling any games that ended up having to be postponed due to COVID. And it's incredibly difficult to reschedule a game in an existing schedule, because it, you know, there's just not a lot of room or space for the two teams to play a new game. But if you start with a blank slate for the second half, we thought we'd have that chance, and it actually worked out. So we had, you know, just over 30 games postponed in the first half. Many of them we were able to reschedule within that first half window, but all the rest, I think we were about 24 games heavy for our second half schedule from, you know, where we originally planned, and all 24 of those were able to be rescheduled. So every team as of now is on track to play their full 72. In a normal year, you probably don't need that, because you don't anticipate that many postponements. What you would potentially get in a normal year is the ability to cater a second half national TV schedule a little bit better to what's happening on the court. And so if there was a team that maybe to start the year wasn't expected to be a top tier team, or a team that was and had an injury, maybe you could tweak your second half schedule to reflect that. And so we're also talking about whether there's elements of that we can build in to have more flexibility in our national television schedule. Although I will say, we also learned that there are some unique challenges that come with trying to do a schedule in two parts. The biggest of which is you have to be really careful about which games you select for the first half schedule. So for example, we had some teams that played a lot of their, you know, like, for example, Western Conference teams that played a lot of their Western Conference opponents in the first half, but not as many of their Eastern Conference opponents. And then when we went and they had some postponements as well, we went to build the second half schedule. Now we had to have that team constantly on back and forth road trips to the East Coast. So you have to sort of manage all of these variables, not just across an entire season, but now twice, right, in both the first half and the second half, and that becomes exponentially more difficult. So that's one we'll discuss as well this offseason, as to whether the potential, you know, TV scheduling benefits might warrant a different approach.
So maybe not withholding the entire second half schedule, but maybe just not figuring out all of the national TV stuff, right? Like, so maybe,
yeah, or you know, I think one thing we learned this year is that our teams are a little more flexible, right, than we've historically thought. And if we want to make minor changes to a schedule, change game times, shift games around, like, we can do that in a way that could be, you know, fan beneficial.
But didn't you have more flexibility to do that because like arenas probably had nothing else going on too? I mean, in a normal year where arenas have concerts and circuses and things, it seems like that would be harder.
Yeah, absolutely. No doubt. I just, you know, again, and we didn't even have full fans, right? So it's yeah. different when you've got 2,000 fans coming than 18,000. But just from a, you know, learning standpoint, we think it's something interesting to think about as we try to, especially as you think about a play-in tournament where you don't know which games are going to be the most compelling, right? And in fact, we have not announced a TV schedule for the last week of the season for this exact reason. We want to make sure the games we're featuring the last week of the year are the most impactful. And if you just say, oh, we're gonna put our top teams and our top players in those slots, well, guess what? Those teams might be locked into playoff spots and those games might not be as compelling as the ones we've talked about where a team's playing for 10 or 9 or 8 or 6. And we want to, you know, make sure we can focus on those.
A couple more before I let you go. We only touched briefly on just, you know, back-to-backs and that kind of thing, or talked about, you know, 4 games in 5 nights and all this. Your group did such an amazing amount of work in the last, you know, however long it's been, 5, 6, 7 years, to make the schedule easier on teams, to lighten the load in the sense of fewer back-to-backs, no 4 games in 5 nights or 5 and 7 and all these other configurations that were traditionally part of the schedule that were really burdensome and exhausting. But lately, and especially the last couple of years with all the other strangeness going on amid a pandemic, I feel like there's a bit of a pendulum swing that, you know, coaches are complaining more and more about we don't have time to practice. And when we have an off day, it's the only, you know, we're playing every other day, basically. So now there, I feel like there's this sense out there, and I'm not saying that this is consensus or majority. It's just a kind of the in the ether of, well, if we had more back-to-backs again, then you have more gaps of 2 or 3 days in a row with no game. There's more time to give players a day off entirely, then have a day of practice, and maybe even the third day where you're doing just film or something. Is there any pendulum swing going on here where after all the efforts you guys have made to make it a little less burdensome on teams that the complaints about lack of playoff or practice time or just downtime is pushing it back in the other direction?
I wouldn't say pushing it back in the other direction, but I certainly think that the pressure to reduce the back-to-backs within the confines of the current schedule has reduced significantly for exactly the reason you highlight, right? So in a normal year, we're playing 82 games in 168 playing days, which for those math folks is roughly a game every other day. So it is theoretically possible to play an 82 game schedule with 0 back-to-backs. You just play every other day for 168 days and you will play your games with no back-to-backs. You'll also never really have any time for practice. That's not a realistic schedule. And so, yes, I think we're at the point where we've reached the theoretical minimum in terms of back-to-back reduction because we do want to maintain those instances of 2 days off, 3 days off for practice, for rests, for travel. And the focus now then is on the actual, what we call back-to-back efficiency. So now can we actually reduce the burden of those back-to-backs? And that's where some of these other travel issues we've talked about come in, right? We haven't talked a lot about home back-to-backs. That was typically a business challenge as well, especially if it's a weeknight. Teams are perfectly happy to host a Friday night and Saturday night home back-to-back, but they didn't love hosting a Monday, Tuesday, because now you're asking, you know, your season ticket holders or individual game buyers to show up for 2 straight games on a Monday and a Tuesday night in the middle of January. That might be tough, but that's a really effective way to reduce the burden of a back-to-back, because now you're playing one, but you don't have to travel, right? Same thing if you go play one of these series where you're in the same market for 2 straight nights. So we think, you know, I don't anticipate any significant further reduction in the number of back-to-backs, but I think we can keep pushing on ways to reduce the burden of those back-to-backs, you know, in the confines of our schedule. And of course, we were also talking about much, much bigger things, right? Like, do we have the right number of games? Do we have the right calendar footprint? Those are obviously longer term questions, but we're, you know, for the here and now, we're focused on more of the quality issues.
It just hit me also, by the way, the playoffs, normal schedule or compressed?
Normal through at least the first 3 rounds and a potentially slightly compressed finals, depending on how long the first 3 rounds take. So basically we're working with a, you know, July 22nd end date to finish before the Olympics open on July 23rd. So that window is about 3 days shorter than a normal playoffs, but we've sort of kept the first few rounds the same with the expectation that if series end early, we can just start the next round you know, with a move up and hopefully maintain the same amount of time off in later rounds. So close enough to a normal playoffs. Yeah.
So the pace of the playoffs will feel familiar to people.
Yes.
So the last time you and I were actually in the same room, I believe, was a year and a couple of months ago, a year and a month ago at the Sloan Conference in Boston, where none of us should have been, where we were all tapping elbows instead of shaking hands, thinking that, oh, that's fine. Oh, look, hey, Purell stations everywhere. We're perfectly safe. Boy, 2020, what a year. But you were on a panel at that weekend where the discussion of permanently shifting the NBA calendar came up. And then as soon as the lockdown happened and people started talking about, oh, how are we going to get the schedule on course again? Is the NBA season going to be able to resume, finish all this? And people started talking about, I think in part because of the momentum out of that discussion at Sloan and the publicity it got, oh, this is the NBA's opportunity to live the dream. Change the schedule permanently forever. That didn't happen, Evan. You guys are doing everything possible, of course, to finish certainly in time for the Olympics. And there, that was always going to be there, but this is going to finish in July. And presumably we are back on course for some sort of normalcy for next season's NBA schedule. In a nutshell, why did the NBA not take this opportunity to just reimagine the entire schedule and go Christmas through July?
Yeah, so Christmas through July means a significant reduction in the number of games, right? So our we talked about calendar footprint. Our traditional footprint is mid-October through mid-June. That's an 8-month stretch. And so if you wanted to start a season around Christmas and play our full slate of games, you're finishing in late August. And I think one thing we learned this year and this past year, recognizing it was an incredibly unique year for TV viewership across the board, but TV viewership is a struggle in July and August, and certainly as you get into September, October, like we did with our playoffs this past year. So I think our network certainly felt and our team certainly felt that being, quote, off cycle was not particularly helpful for us this past year, and we're going to be off cycle again this summer with our finals running in July. We'll see how those do. But I think coming off of two very challenging years from a health perspective, but also from a business perspective, we want to get back to our normal calendar because of the familiarity with our fans of that calendar and what it means for viewership, attendance, and play throughout the year. That doesn't mean that we've ruled out revisiting these things. I just think until you're at the point where you're saying we actually don't want to play 82 games anymore, it's pretty hard to talk about calendar shifts because, yes, there might be some benefit to starting a little bit later and reducing the competition with NFL, college football, baseball playoffs, but the back end is not particularly helpful going into July and August. And so the broader conversation has to be about a fundamental overhaul to the economic model of the league with fewer games. And I think, again, coming off of the challenges these 2 years, that just wasn't something that was high on our list for now, but I certainly expect us to revisit that.
Yeah. I mean, if nothing else, we now know, I don't want to say definitively because there's nothing definitive about anything that happened last year in any part of society, but that it's probably not in the NBA's best interest to be playing in July and August if it can avoid it.
Correct. That is our short-term conclusion as well.
All right. Last thing. Best guess, or maybe it's more than a guess, is next season going to start somewhere in the mid to third week of October and look like a normal season with not only 82 games and playoffs and all that, but with normal pacing and normal just everything? Are we on track for what looks like a normal season next season?
Yeah, I mean, I would say one of the primary reasons, as you noted, that we started in late December this year, are playing a 72-game season and looking to conclude before the Olympics, is so that we can get back on track for next season. And since, as we sit here at the end of April, and we are still on track to finish a full 72-game season in the next 2.5 weeks, and we are still on track to finish our playoffs by that July 22nd date. If that happens, then yes, I think we anticipate a return to normalcy next year, which, you know, would mean that mid to late October start and a June final. So that is certainly our hope sitting here today.
Hallelujah. I think we all wondered for a while if we'd ever get there. Not that I ever had any loss of faith that you and your group would figure it out one way or another.
And somehow it'll only be 18 months from the moment we shut down the league to the return to normalcy, but it'll certainly have felt like quite a bit longer.
Yeah, I think it's 10 years. You can't convince me otherwise. Evan Wash, this has been great. Thank you so much for coming on. I know from previously having these discussions with you and Tom Corelli on my old podcast, people love this stuff. They love hearing the explanations, the machinations behind the scheduling and all this. And especially at a time like now when things have never been more challenging for you guys and more strange, I think, for fans. So thank you for enlightening us again. Appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me, Howard.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.